enter line, press pound 6.
On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, Incremental Sampling Methodology Update, known as ISM2. These are the first three modules for the new updated training from the ISM2 2020 document. My name is Nicole Henderson. I'm your moderator today from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. This training is an introduction to the ITRC online guidance document produced in 2020, and we're hoping that you will get an overview of the guidance document and an introduction for the training modules to learn more on how to use it. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, or the ITRC, and is hosted by the US EPA Cleanup Information Network, also known as CLUIN. Some of our housekeeping rules for today, we wanted to let you know that this training is being recorded and it will be offered on demand through CLUIN for those not able to join us live. The CLUIN training page offers the slides for you to download under Download Training Materials. At any time during today's presentation, please use the Q&A box to ask questions, make comments, or report technical problems. For those of you that are interested in receiving certificates of completion, that will be available upon the completion of the feedback form, and you will find that at the very end of the presentation. The Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council is a program of the Environmental Council of the States. ITRC is a state-led organization composed of over 1,000 members from state agencies, the federal government, the private sector, academia, and community stakeholders. ITRC's members participate in technical teams which produce tools, resources, and training courses such as the one you are participating in today. If you'd like to be a part of ITRC, please visit the ITRC website. On the website, you can register for teams and learn more about how you can become an active ITRC team member. Additionally, the full ITRC disclaimer is available on the website. If you plan to use ITRC materials, we ask that you review that policy in detail and be sure to credit ITRC. And today, I would like to welcome our ISM2 update team leaders, Troy Keith and Caroline Gelanti. Troy, welcome.
Thank you, Nicole. Hi, and welcome. I'm Troy Keith from the Tennessee Department of Environment and Conservation and one of the co-leads for ISM2. ITRC issued the Incremental Sampling Methodology Guidance, known as ISM-1, in February 2012. Since that time, many more states and consultants have adopted its use, and we found that it could benefit from an update. What started out as an update really turned into more of a complete overhaul of the original document, with input from experts and practitioners across the nation and even from other countries. The revised and updated ITRC Guidance, ISM-2, was developed to build on the 2012 version to reflect advancements in technology and to share case studies that simply were unavailable at the time of ISM-1 and that provide insight into potential applications, benefits, and challenges of the ISM approach. The ISM-2 update team also determined that clarification of incorrect, unclear, or inconsistent information in ISM-1 was also necessary. A clarification statement is now appended at the beginning of the ISM-1 document, and ISM-1 continues to be a useful and valuable tool for those interested in learning the concepts of ISM-1.
Hello, and thank you for joining us today. My name is Caroline Gelanti, and I'm from the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation. Troy and I have served as state team leaders for the ISM-2 update team, and today we will be your moderators. Throughout this training, we are going to be introducing you to our expert trainers in each module.
As mentioned earlier, the updated ITRC Incremental Sampling Methodology Guidance Document, ISM-2, was developed to build on the 2012 version, ISM-1, and to reflect advancements in technology, incorporate the lessons learned by practitioners over the past 8 years, and share case studies that provide insight into potential applications, benefits, and challenges of the ISM approach. ISM-2 contains 9 sections and an appendix with case studies, as well as an update to the statistical simulations contained in ISM-1. The ITRC ISM2 training modules will not cover all the sections of the guidance document, so we strongly encourage you to visit the web-based document and explore all the tools and resources available there.
The ISM2 update team created this training as a series of 6 modules. These are designed to be standalone modules to help participants understand specific components of ISM, and these modules can be viewed separately or in any order preferred by the participant. Module 1 will provide an overview to orient participants to the concept of ISM and the guidance document. Module 2 discusses the importance of small-scale and large-scale heterogeneity. Module 3 recognizes the common statistical misconceptions and pitfalls in sample planning and analysis and how to avoid them. Module 4 will provide a variety of examples and techniques to help you understand the field sampling methods used for ISM. Module 5 provides a comprehensive review of the lab and analytical side of ISM and how it impacts the quality of your results. And Module 6 is going to be your go-to resource for what you need to know about using ISM data in risk assessment and risk-based decision making. Also, please don't forget that the ISM1 team developed a 2-part training that is still available on CLUIN. These trainings provide additional in-depth information on ISM for those wanting to dig deeper on the sampling methodology. As part of the ISM2 document and training development, our team reviewed these trainings and determined that these resources are still relevant and current. The ISM2 team is excited to present to you these new training opportunities and hope that you can use this information to help with your environmental sites. Please remember to visit our full guidance document for all tools and resources that were developed by the ISM2 update team.
Welcome to the introduction module for ITRC ISM guidance update. I'm Troy Keith from the Tennessee Department of Environment Conservation. During this module, we will provide an overview of incremental sampling, including applications and benefits. This is the first of 6 training modules provided by ITRC on ISM2. Specifically, Module 1 will discuss clarifying common misconceptions of ISM, expanded understanding of ISM applications through case studies, and the benefits of using ISM at various sites, i.e. confidence in data. I appreciate the opportunity to introduce our expert trainers. Not only do they serve as volunteer trainers for ITRC, they both were active members of ITRC's ISM2 update team, and a special thank you to them for participating today. If you'd like to read more about their expertise, you can access their bios at the link at the bottom of the page. And now I will pass it off to Jason Broderson and Chris Christensen.
All right, thanks, Troy. Thanks for the introduction, and welcome, everyone, to the introduction module. Nicole, can you go ahead and start up our poll question and give us an idea of everyone's familiarity with ISM? And while she's doing that, this overview, just want to summarize, is going to include applications and benefits of incremental sampling, and specifically, I'm going to be talking about the big picture of ISM and include some of its benefits along with many examples along the way. And then Chris is going to dive deeper into the nitty-gritty of implementing ISM. This is the first of 6 training modules. For the updated guidance manual and its conclusion, Chris is going to go into each of the 5 modules. I guess we didn't really get the whole question. That's okay. All right, well, let's just jump right in. What is ISM? Simply stated, it is a very robust composite sampling methodology, which is based on a 2-step process. The first step is the identification of your decision unit. The decision unit is the area or volume of soil which you are interested in finding out the concentration of soil. The second portion of the process is collecting that soil sample. And here's where it's different than traditional sampling is that you'll be collecting anywhere between a minimum of 30 to 100 plus increments collected from each decision unit. The increment is a small, something between 10 and 30 grams of soil that will be distributed throughout the entire decision unit. And the goal of that sample is usually you're looking at getting a mass of about a kilogram at a minimum. Those increments, like I said, are combined to form your single concentration for the decision unit. And I also want to point out that there's a very specific and improved laboratory processing protocol that's associated with incremental sampling. The emphasis in ISM is really on coverage and understanding the repeatability and defensibility of our soil sampling. And a lot of that is dependent upon the collection and reliance upon replicate samples, sometimes referred to as triplicate samples if there happens to be three of them. And that replicate sample is simply the same sample you collect for your decision unit, but collected in a slightly different manner in terms of stepping off in several feet or providing the increment distribution at a different random mechanism. So what are the benefits of ISM? Basically, you have this incredible increased coverage, and then that the replicate analysis enables us to maximize our confidence in decision making. It uses resources wisely, and the bottom line is much reduced lab costs, but getting a high confidence soil result the first time almost always results in fewer, if not no, additional mobilizations and coming to our conclusions with a much greater level of confidence. And it lets us focus on areas that are contaminating or providing the appropriate supporting information for areas which are not. And so, why is this critical? Well, we all know that we need to have high confidence in our decisions. After all, many of us are scientists, engineers, and professionals, and we work in a challenging field. Our decisions have to hold up to client, stakeholder, and agencies and community scrutiny. I mean, I'm a consultant, and I want to make sure that I'm spending my clients' money in an efficient and effective manner. And I also have to meet, you know, professional standards that our industry is accustomed to. And honestly, it's something that historically I haven't felt that comfortable with when looking at traditional discrete sampling. And why didn't I have that confidence? I think we all know that there are inherent challenges in what we do, three primary ones. One is just soil heterogeneity. Two is contaminant distribution and its heterogeneity. And three, let's face it, just the unknown nature of our site histories. And yet we need this high confidence in every step of decision making. And I think that for those of you who've been around as long as some of us, the last 30 years have shown us that the use of high variability in traditional discrete results have resulted in uncertainty. And let's just take a look at some of these examples on that slide. And you can see that just stepping across 1 foot often or just a couple of feet on your sample programs can show you orders of magnitude changes in your contaminants. And I'm sure you guys have all seen these sorts of results in the past. So, you know, what does this mean, the heterogeneity? Many of us are very used to this idea that we get this sample dig, endless do loop. What that does is it wastes time, it wastes money, and it exposes that low confidence that we might have had in traditional discrete sampling. And you know, we just can't afford to make low confidence decisions regarding cleanups. Repercussions are too large and important. Okay, how to apply ISM. It can be used in any investigation area size. It can be used in something as small as a storm drain. It can be applied to something as large as a commercial or agricultural lot. It can be used in all investigation phases, from scoping and due diligence through site investigation, through nature and extent, remedial investigation. It can be used in stockpile sampling. It can be used in confirmation sampling. It can be used in remedial designs. So you name it. If you're interested in the soil concentration, the ISM can be applied. It can be used in all sample types, near surface, subsurface, confirmation sampling, et cetera. I mean, subsurface causes or presents some unique challenges, but if we're interested in high confidence results, then those challenges need to be overcome. Also can be used for all analytes listed here, metals, pesticides, PCBs, FCFCs, PFAS, DACs, and furans, and yes, VOCs. It is a compositing technique, but working with your lab and understanding the use of methanol preservative means that you can collect VOC samples for ISM without any implication on the integrity of your sample result. Okay, So how does ISM increase our confidence? Well, I talked about this idea that you're going to be collecting 30 to 100 soil increments, and that provides orders of magnitude of coverage over traditional sampling. And coverage, let's face it, I mean, that's what helps us find contamination. The collection of replicates enables us to evaluate and quantify our reproducibility, hence increased confidence. And even with your defendable single sample results, those replicates help us quantify, and you can add statistical confidence intervals if necessary. And let's, you know, look at the bottom line of replicability, repeatability. It's the cornerstone of the scientific method, and the emphasis of replicate samples in gives ISM a solid foundation in science. It reminds me of when my older daughter was in seventh grade. She came home from school one day. Excuse me. She said, well, our science experiment is to put a glass of milk on a warm windowsill and test the pH and see how long it takes until it goes sour. And she said, but for whatever reason, the teacher said that we need to have three glasses of milk and not just one. And why is that? Isn't that just a waste of milk? And I kind of explained to her, well, no, that's the deal with the scientific method, is it has to be reproducible. And that little anecdote kind of, I always remembered it because it just reminds me of, it's the same for us in our soil sampling. It needs to be reproducible. So again, this is accomplished at generally lower costs. You vastly improve your schedules just because of fewer remobs. And the nice thing is, like I said, you get results the first time, positive results the first time, high confidence, and it minimizes that need for step out, and it often reduces that sample dig do loop. So at this point, I'm just going to run through a number of examples of ISM and how it can be used. I mean, starting from the simplest and then moving to slightly more advanced examples. You might have a transformer storage area with some stress vegetation nearby, and so that stress vegetation area might be your decision unit. Perhaps a chemical mixing facility with visual staining like the first time looks like a simple area you're interested in, that first to you. And then maybe there are some patches that are further away that you're also interested in understanding the concentrations to set up a second decision unit. Perhaps a planned excavation. You want to sample the sidewalls or the area around that excavation, and so you take what we sometimes call perimeter decision units along the edges of that excavation. Situation where there's air dispersion and we're looking at decision units or, and I'll get to this in a second, sampling units, which are maybe dispersed laterally out from the suspected source area. Let me just talk quickly about this SU sampling unit and DU decision unit. It's in the document, it explains it. I really think people should not get hung up on the distinction between an SU and a DU. There are some practitioners that choose to use the term DU for any incremental sample. There are other practitioners that prefers to use the term SU when a final site decision is not being made based on that. So for example, in this situation, perhaps the decision is going to be understanding the concentrations of each of the SUs. But honestly, the terms can be used interchangeably, and there's really, like I said, no reason to get hung up on it. Here's an example where a industrial facility with no known history, and there's a large field behind it, and the idea would be, let's just take it and split it into a grid. And then maybe there's a shed out there where we are interested in smaller areas of concentrations, and so you take that grid and subdivide it into a smaller grid. It gives you an idea that you can kind of divide, there's no one size fits all for SUs or DUs. You do it based on your project needs. And often ISM can be used for exposure units. In this situation or this example, you might want to be running risk assessments on a backyard exposure, so you establish a backyard DU. There's an orchard DU that is split into three. Perhaps there was apples in one and peaches in another, and I don't know, bananas in a third. The idea that you want to understand three different concentrations. And you can split in garden DUs, front yard DUs. Once again, just another example of take your area, design your DU for your project needs. So let's just jump right into a specific project example. This is the Rylander Park Community Center in Nebraska. It was an old, it was a legacy rail yard. And you can see from this image the different sorts of decision units that were set up based on use. For example, there's a number of softball fields. There's some baseball fields. I think there were some soccer fields out there. And what they did is they were interested in understanding soil concentrations at two depth intervals, from 0 to 2, which is what the community would be exposed to in general use, and then 2 to 12 inches, which is what maintenance workers might have been exposed to. So here are the results. I'm just going to look at lead. Lead was one of the primary metals of concern. And from historic sampling, there were two areas that they suspected would be hot. And one of them was this DU9 hot. And you can see that, in fact, that lead jumps out as hot. I mean, it's an order of magnitude. This idea that one of the perceptions I'll talk about in a bit about dilution is, if there's contamination there, you'll see it. And then look at this DU9 hot that was suspected. Well, it turns out it wasn't elevated over the cleanup level. And as a result, soil removal actions were conducted. The state had high confidence in the result and was able to, you know, present to the public. It was well received, and all the resources were spent where they were needed, and resources were not spent where they weren't. So I kind of jumped into one of the common misperceptions about sample dilution and the idea that perhaps you're not going to see your hotspot, quote unquote. And I just want to hit a couple misperceptions quickly. There's not enough time to go through all of these. The document does talk about it. I think that one thing in terms of the elevated concentrations diluting, one of the original uses of incremental sampling was by miners in order to find trace elements. So this idea of diluting and not finding something, if one of the intended initial uses was for mining, obviously that's something that they wanted to find elevated trace elements, not dilute them. Skepticism about volatile organics. As I mentioned earlier, it is not a concern at all for ISM. All you have to do is work with your lab, understand methanol preservation, and VOC sampling is as easy as anything else. Excuse me. It must be extensive labor and time to collect all those increments. Chris is going to go into that a little bit, but really, it's not a big effort collecting, especially surface samples. You can collect. It's not uncommon to collect a decision unit in less than 20 minutes. The main savings, though, in terms of if there is additional labor and time, is that you make up for that in orders of magnitude on the back end because you get data that you can use the first time. I need to know the maximum concentration. I mean, I think this is a challenging one. I guess I would just challenge everyone who makes those statements to go back to that original slide. Think about the idea that variability can change in orders of magnitude at most of our sites just by moving over a couple of feet. And so the idea that a discrete or a traditional sampling methodology that shows variability is giving you the maximum concentration, I don't know that that is something that we would all feel confident in, and is it something we really need to know in the first place? So again, I encourage everyone to look through the guidance. Many of the modules following this one will go into more detail and help you understand some of these common misperceptions. All right, I am going to run through an example of how one might set up different options for the same area. So let's look at a residential backyard exposure area, and the decision is going to be made for the entire area. Oops, sorry. I clicked the wrong button. So the conceptual model is perhaps there was a air dispersion and there could be small pockets of elevated contamination within that backyard. So elevated pockets might look something like this, where the orange dots are concentrations over a cleanup level, and the green are concentrations below. So the two scenarios, let's look at exposure across the entire area, and let's also look at splitting the backyard into smaller areas and in order to address if there are smaller elevated concentrations. So in the first scenario, you have one decision unit and you have 30 total increments. So that's what it might look like. Gives you an idea of the coverage. And the result is you get an average concentration over that entire area. In the second scenario, let's say that the users want to split that into 9 DUs or SUs. Like I said, it doesn't really matter at this point, and 30 increments each. And now you really get incredible coverage if you think about that. I mean, 30 times 9, you can see that if there is contamination out there, your increments will pick it up. And so you get this the idea that you get a higher resolution. That higher resolution allows for perhaps cleanup of specific areas. And in this case, for example, maybe these two areas merit a removal action. Okay, one more real example. This is a former power plant in Molokai, Hawaii. Like the Rylander example, it was proposed as a community center. And there was historic sampling with discrete samples. And the original conceptual site model from a PCB transformer activity, that was the source, showed that there were portions of elevated PCBs in the northwestern portion of the property. And so you can see that from the red, and then the green were clean discrete samples. So incremental sampling came into Hawaii after that project had started, and they set up decision units. The red ones focusing on areas that they suspected were contaminated, and that the blue areas, slightly larger DUs, were areas that were perimeter DUs where they did not anticipate finding contamination based on the original conceptual site model. So again, this is what the original conceptual site model looked like, and here's what the results from the incremental sampling showed. It confirmed that there was contamination in that northwest area, But it also found unacceptable contamination down along the southern portion of the property. And so really what that means is that incremental sampling enabled the state to focus their cleanup on areas that really needed it, and had it not been conducted, concentrations of unacceptable concentrations would have been left in place, leaving the community at risk. Okay, so getting to the end of my portion here, I want to talk about some example triplicate results. Before I jump right into them, I want to talk about those of you who've been around long enough like me when I started in 1989, this idea that how can you trust the data? Well, EPA in its early days of Superfund, it did recommend collecting duplicate soil samples. And we would collect, out of your sleeve, it would come out of the ground. You would, maybe every 10, every 20%, you would run two of those sleeves at the same time. And I look back at it, it's pretty funny. We would find that the concentrations were pretty different. And the question was always, well, what do we do with those concentrations? And sometimes it was, well, let's just average them. Well, let's take the higher one. And then at some point, somebody probably said, well, what about all the samples that we didn't take a duplicate from? What do we make of those? And the answer was, let's just not collect replicates anymore. Honestly, I mean, that is what happened. So the idea of replicate soil samples was stopped. And so ISM, it's the opposite. We embrace it. We want to collect triplicates and replicates so that we can evaluate how confident we are in the data. Let me just run through a couple quick examples. So in red, these are triplicate concentrations for arsenic, 290, 230, 230. Very good, very tight. Here's another for lower concentrations, but still over the action level, 50, 47, 49. Here's an example we're looking at arsenic, and you look at the bottom one shows the triplicate results where you have 500, 41, 490. And really what that does, it helps you understand that, well, that 300 up there, if replicates have been taken from there, you would get some idea of what their variability might be based on the exposure area due on the southern portion. And here's a site actually that's active right now. I'm working on one of my sites for University of California at Berkeley, where we're testing PCBs. PCBs are notorious for high heterogeneity. And look at some of these triplicate results that we have. 1.52, 2.02, 1.15, and then on the right, 0.52, 0.47, 0.53. So really incredible confidence when we take replicates with ISM sampling. Okay, to close my portion of the presentation, just I want to summarize. ISM is designed to be efficient and effective use of your resources. The lower lab costs, and you get higher quality and defendable results the first time, often minimizing or completely eliminating further investigations. It's highly versatile, can be used at any time, any site, any objective, and this incredible sample coverage and replicates helps us capture and quantify that heterogeneity, and it results in higher confidence in our decisions. And for me, it enables me to feel really great about how I've spent the resources on my project. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Chris.
Thanks, Jason. So how do you go about collecting your ISM sample? Well, it all starts with establishing your decision unit, the volume of soil you're interested in. In ISM, there's a very heavy emphasis on systematic planning and how you're going to use the data. That's the fundamental basis for how decision units are established. The goal of ISM is to obtain and analyze a sample that contains mass and therefore analytes in the same proportions as the soil throughout the entire decision unit. As discussed, it can be anything small, large, or anything in between. It's always a project-specific decision based on your data quality objectives. Collecting ISM sample increments involves the systematic sampling of small soil samples from throughout the decision unit. They're most often collected in a random systematic grid to help ensure that representative coverage. Here's a video of ISM being done in a public park for metals. As you can see, we have one flagger, one person pushing a step probe about 4 inches into the ground and placing it into a tray. Sometimes we use Ziploc baggies. Usually the goal is to get to 1 kilogram of soil to send to the lab. There is no deconning in between increments. However, you would want to decon if you were doing replicates samples. It goes pretty quick. One of my most recent ISM projects, we sampled 3 residential yards in half a day. Another key element of sampling approach is the collection of these resamples, the typically 3 replicates. These replicates are collected with consistent coverage, but the increments are located at different locations within the decision unit, as the X, the circles, squares, and triangles show. The replicates results enable you to understand the heterogeneity of your decision unit, as well as understand how well the number of increments capture the concentrations within that decision unit. Significant differences between replicates may trigger you to collect more increments or make the decision unit smaller. As Jason mentioned, surface samples is pretty easy. Subsurface increments can be more challenging as they require drilling techniques and collection of increments from cores, either through wedges or plugs. This can be done either in place or in soil piles. Each ISM project will generate its own unique set of results and uses of those results. ISM projects may use single results. There is no requirement in ISM2 for replicates or UCL calculations. ISM can also be done with these multiple results and use of confidence intervals through the collection of these replicates. In Michigan, for example, we recommend 10% of the DUs be done in triplicate to gauge that reproducibility. Ideally, the initial results will provide you all the data necessary for your decisions if the sample design is correct. But regardless of planning, there can be unforeseen or unexpected concentrations, which really should not be surprising since we often really do not know where the contamination exists. Because if we did, that's the only place we would sample. So it's not uncommon to reevaluate the data to determine if additional decision units or changes to the sampling plan are needed. In terms of types of uses, ISM can be used for any project needing soil concentrations, including property transfers and acquisitions, brownfields, site characterization, risk assessment, sediment model loading, bait and transport studies. For example, you can use it to test engineering parameters like concentrations of soil through a treatment train or any other use where you want to know the average concentration of soil in any volume, the average concentration in any volume of soil. Let me repeat that. ISM can be used anywhere where you need to know the average concentration in any volume of soil. In Michigan, we have used it in a neighborhood downwind of a brass foundry for lead, river sediments downstream of an iron nickel mine, residential development of old orchards that had used lead arsenate pesticides, VOC contamination at gas station excavation sidewalls, PFAS in dump sites and in biosolid ag fields, and stockpiles in an old oil refinery. There are a ton of case studies out there. The bottom line is you can use the results to get you to the next step, whether it be cleanup, no action, or anything in between. ISM is a cost-effective and scientifically defensible sampling technique designed to provide you with results to support highly confident decisions. It is not just another tool in the toolbox. It provides incredible sample coverage, and the use of replicates enables you to quantify the confidence in those results. Larger coverage and increased confidence results in fewer phases or mobilizations that sample dig routine, and therefore faster and more effective cleanup decisions. Most ISM projects derive their final conclusions in one single mobilization. The ISM method is designed to ensure that existing contaminant concentration levels are captured or to justify that no contamination is present, if that is the case. As Troy said at the beginning, this is one of six modules. There are five upcoming modules. Module 2 discusses the importance of small and large-scale heterogeneity. Soil is inherently heterogeneous, and because of that heterogeneity, traditional grab sample approaches can substantially over or underestimate the true mean concentration of contaminants present. This module shows how ISM reduces the errors inherent in traditional sampling approaches and provides representative samples suitable for accurate decision making. Module 3 recognizes the common statistical misconceptions and how to avoid them. Wondering what UCL to choose and how to calculate it, learn how to use the UCL calculator in the statistics module. Module 4 provides a variety of examples and techniques to help you understand the field sampling methods. This module goes over a comprehensive field planning checklist and covers how to locate and collect your instruments. Module 5 provides a comprehensive review of the laboratory and analytical side of ISM and how it impacts the quality of your data. There's really a field component and a laboratory component, and you really have to be on the same page with the lab. This module will help project planners select sample processing options to manage that micro-scale heterogeneity and to preserve representativeness. It will explain the most common processing options and has videos of milling and 2D slab cake subsampling. And Module 6 is all about risk assessment and risk-based decision-making. You can use ISM data for risk assessment for providing an accurate estimate of the true mean for a scientifically defensible risk assessment. It also covers 95% UCLs, establishing background concentrations, post-remediation confirmation sampling, and risk communication. ISM has been proven over the last decade. These benefits have been borne out in a significant increase in use across the nation since our first ISM tech reg. The number of states where ISM has been done has increased from 30% in 2012 to 85% currently. Sites finish faster with fewer mobilizations. Scientists are skeptical, as Jason said. I started off as a skeptic when I first heard of this approach, but honestly, I've never run into a team who has implemented ISM who hasn't embraced it for its cost effectiveness and just higher quality data. As a state regulator, there's nothing more satisfying when I have to stand in front of a public meeting and have confidence in my data. ISM gives you that superior data. I would highly encourage you to check out our case study section in ISM 2 to see how ISM can work for your project. Thank you, and we'll now open the floor to questions.
Thank you, Chris and Jason. We'd like to hear back from you today, so please be sure to fill out the online feedback form that's linked on this last slide. You can also access the feedback form by clicking Feedback in the related links section and then clicking Browse To. Filling out the feedback form and certifying that you participated will allow you to receive a certificate of completion by email. ITRC also archives all its training classes, so if you find that you have additional time or are looking for additional training opportunities, please visit ClueIn and the archive trainings to see if there are other courses that might interest you. So at this time, we'll open up the question and answer portion of our training. At any time, you can type your question in the Q&A pod at the bottom right corner of your screen, and we'll try to get through as many of these questions today as we can. So the first question, we'll go give this one to Chris. Can you explain in further detail how ISM can be applied to VOCs without contamination loss? In other words, what special sampling measures must be applied to get a representative sample result?
Right. So I've done it at a couple of sites. Actually, Mark Bruce will give a presentation on the lab section, the module. He does a great job of presenting that as well. Basically, it's a one-to-one methanol to grams of soil. So you just need to make sure that you have the jars, whether they're 40 mil vials or large amber jars of methanol, and you take your plugs and you put them in the jar. It's a one-to-one ratio, like I said. So Mark Bruce does a great job of going over that, but Jason's done it. I've done it. And usually that's one of the main questions, but it can easily be done.
Perfect. Thank you. Okay, another question. Jason, we'll give this one to you. Based on your experience, will state regulatory agencies ask for discrete sampling to delineate the decision units?
Well, I mean, I think every state is different, and I don't know. I mean, I guess that's the only way I can answer that, is that every state is different. I think it's up to the consultant to understand the conceptual site model, and really my advice would be just go in there with decision units to start off, not discrete sampling. Like I said, discrete sampling is going to introduce a whole bunch of uncertainty in understanding whether something is or isn't there. I would always start with incremental sampling.
And I would just add that really that's the data quality objective process, is having those discussions when you don't have everything figured out with all the parties involved, you know, the consultant, the client, and the regulator in the room, and trying to make sure you're on the same page before you're sampling and why you're sampling in the first place through the DTO process.
Okay. Another one is, if there is a potential for significant spatial gradient, i.e. large hotspot, but no existing screening data set of discrete samples, how can you get confident, or how can you confidently assign decision unit boundaries other than using guesses based on historical site uses? If a DU captures an edge of a hotspot, which brings the average above the compliance limit, how can you say with confidence that the entire decision unit needs to be addressed?
You want me to answer that, Troy?
Yeah, Jason, go for it.
I mean, so when you're setting up your decision units, the question you're answering is, what's my concentration across that entire decision unit? If you're interested in concentrations within the decision unit, then you can't do that with a single ISM sample. If that's the case, you split it into smaller decision units. So if you're looking at exposure concentration, it really actually shouldn't matter if one edge of that decision unit has a higher or a lower concentration if the overall average exposure is for that decision unit. So it's kind of a complex question. I'm not sure that I answered it. But you're looking at a concentration within the decision unit. It doesn't matter if it's on the edge or the middle or the side.
And I would just add that, you know, you get DUs two different ways, either from the historic information like the peach orchard or the apple orchard, or on a future use, right? So if you're going to develop that into quarter-acre residential lot, then that would be part of your DU makeup. But really that needs to come out through, needs to be settled on ahead of time before you start sampling. And that's the DQO process with the regulator, the client, and the consultant.
Okay, thank you. We've got time for a couple of more questions, so we'll give this one to Tom Marr, who's on the next module, but how does ISM impact waste characterization disposal, i.e. high levels and characteristic waste?
Thanks, Troy. But, you know, the ISM use in characterizing the DUs is a completely different step from characterizing your waste stream. ISM can be used to characterize waste streams. I'll get into that a little bit in the next section. But, you know, when you characterize a waste stream, you're truly supposed to characterize the entire waste stream, not just any individual particle within that waste. So ISM actually works quite well when it's applied to sampling your waste.
Thank you, Tom. Looks like we lost the connection. Okay.
I still hear you on the phone.
Yeah, everything's rebooting. Okay.
Here, Troy. I'll take it right now. So we do have time for one more question. Oh, Jason, I believe this one is best fit for you. If you exceed the standard of cleanup in a DU, could you go back and collect smaller subsets of the DU to determine exactly where there might be isolated concentrations, or would the whole DU be remediated?
Well, this is a great question, Nicholas, and I'm glad you asked it because if you just listen to the presentation and my emphasis and Chris's emphasis on, you know, single mobilizations, it might lead you to believe that that's all you can do or all you should do, but really that's not true. And what you're saying is a great example. The question brings up this idea that if you have a decision unit with an elevated concentration, but you're not committed to excavating or remediating that entire decision unit, then absolutely the thing to do is to go in there. In fact, and split it into four, maybe six smaller decision units or sampling units. I think that it's one of the best uses of incremental sampling is to start big and then kind of hone in on areas that you can focus your resources on. So it's not a one-stop shopping and a one-time only shopping. So I hope that answers the question. It's a good question. Again, you can always go back and split it into smaller decision units if you want to make decisions on smaller areas.
Okay. Thank you, Jason. That's all the time we have for Q&A right now, but if you need further clarification on answers or would like to ask more questions, feel free to email us at training@itrcweb.org, and we will follow up with our trainers to get your questions answered. A special thanks to all of our participants today, and thank you to Jason and Chris for being here and contributing to the ITRC document and this training effort. And now we will move on.
For those of you joining us for Module 2, I'm Caroline Gelanti with the New York State DEC, and I've been working with the update team as a state co-lead throughout this project. Module 2 is the second of six training modules, and will introduce and explain the importance of understanding heterogeneity in soil and how it can impact site data reliability. We will be discussing and introducing GI theory, which is a sampling methodology that ISM is modeled after. Our trainers will also be discussing sampling design based on heterogeneity, and the impact of heterogeneity on decision errors, soil sampling processes, and decision making. A special thank you to our expert trainers for Module 2, Michelle Zeich and Tom Mayer. If you'd like to read more about their expertise, you can access their bios using the link at the bottom of this page. So let's move on to our next slide, and I'll pass off the presentation to Michelle.
Great. Thank you, Carolyn. Welcome, everyone, to Module 2 of the ISM update. This module will look at what is heterogeneity in soil, how heterogeneity can lead to sampling errors, and we'll show how ISM can reduce the effects of heterogeneity and generate more representative data. This module covers information provided in sections 2 and 3.1 of ISM2. Now, as practitioners of environmental assessment and remediation, we perform sampling to collect representative data to make a decision. In our industry, this decision is typically about the condition of a property, specifically whether there are chemicals that make it unsafe for either redevelopment, occupancy, and pose a hazard to existing habitats. Decisions require representative data, And soil heterogeneity makes it difficult to collect such data. Errors in sampling can impact decisions and outcomes of an assessment. An improper decision can lead to wasting time and money for additional assessment, or a bad decision can lead to remediate clean soil or leave dirty soil in place, risking the health of the inhabitants or spreading contaminants to drinking water or neighboring properties. Now, before we go too much further, we should talk about heterogeneity. For those of you who have conducted soil sampling know, it is really hard to get reproducible results in soil because it is not uniform. Heterogeneity is the term we use to describe that the soil is not uniform. The term relates to the variability of its physical and chemical properties. Now, these properties are not equally distributed within the soil, and this is the reason for the variability. The illustration here on this slide is an example of sample variability in the field. The samples were all collected within 3 feet of each other, and in some cases, the analytical results varied as much as 3 orders of magnitude. Which of these results is representative of the chemical concentration at the site? And if only one sample were collected, the data would not be representative of actual soil conditions and could ultimately lead to the wrong action. Now, soil heterogeneity is observed on large and small scales. Small-scale heterogeneity is the result of dissimilar and diverse particle constituents in the soil. It's also dependent upon the physical attributes of the soil, including its composition, its particle shape, size, and density. This picture is of a magnified particles of iron hydroxide and silicate minerals in soil. Here, you can see that the arsenic coats the iron hydroxide particles and not the silicate minerals because of its chemical properties, and it creates almost a nugget of high arsenic concentrations. Now, large-scale distributional heterogeneity occurs across the site. It's observed when two or more samples collected adjacent to each other have very different concentrations. It's the result of a contaminant release and depositional mechanisms. Things like unequal dispersion, preferential absorption, dissolution, evection, erosion, and weathering are all causes of large-scale heterogeneity. In this particular example, a truck trailer carrying a white liquid chemical has overturned and it spills its contents. Think about it. The liquid's going to follow the topography. The liquid flows around the bumps and into the swells. It moves unevenly on the surface. It's absorbed into the soil in more in some areas than it is in others. Now, if sampling were to be performed at this site years later, when the spill is no longer visible, the bumps and swells have eroded, it would be very difficult to predict where contaminants are present. You could have low and high concentrations immediately adjacent to each other. And the key item is neither sample is representative of the overall site conditions. So we're going to move on to our first knowledge check. Nicole, can you please pull up the poll? Now, our question is, what makes collecting representative soil samples at this site so difficult? Is it due to the dissimilar and diverse particle constituents in the soil? The nugget effect, where contaminants stick more to one particle over the other, variations in contaminant release and deposition, or is it due to the effects of contaminant dissolution, evection, soil disturbances, and weathering? Or is the answer E, all of the above? I'll give you a few moments to make your selections. Fabulous. It looks like most of you have got it all right. There are many reasons that inhibit collection of truly representative samples in soil. So the answer is E, all of the above. Now with that, I'm going to hand it over to Tom to talk a little bit about the sources of sampling error. Tom?
Thank you, Michelle. Before we talk about how to develop an ISM sampling design to collect representative samples, let's take a look at some of the most common sources of sampling error and how you can use ISM to reduce the magnitude of these errors. Dr. Pierre Guy was a leader in developing the theory of particulate matter sampling. He spent over 25 years developing procedures for collecting representative samples of particulate matter, such as mineral ore and cereal grains. Representative samples are vital to many industries, including, for example, the mining industry. Non-representative data can result in the mining industry either spending a whole lot of money trying to extract poor quality ore or overlooking valuable ore deposits that would have proved very profitable had it been mined. These theories and techniques have proven so valuable, they are included in sampling guidance documents issued by US EPA and others. He identified seven principal errors that negatively impact the ability to collect representative samples. Five of these errors are addressed in detail within ISM-2. The other two types of errors were discussed in detail in ISM-1. The five sampling errors that are addressed in ISM-2 are fundamental sampling error, which is caused by the physical and chemical characteristics of the soil particles themselves. And then there are four errors that are caused by sample collection and preparation techniques, either in the field or in the laboratory. These four types of errors include grouping and segregation error, delimitation error, extraction error, and preparation error. Each of these errors and methods to reduce the magnitude of each error are described on the following slides. But before we get into discussing the errors addressed in ISM-2, let's quickly revisit the other two sources of error identified by Guy that were addressed in ISM-1. These two errors are caused by heterogeneities that occur primarily in a temporal or one-dimensional context. ISM-2 and most of us environmental practitioners consider only the two-dimensional or three-dimensional spatial context. The first type of temporal or one-dimensional error is long-range heterogeneity fluctuation error. This is due to distributional heterogeneity between adjacent areas of the site. In other words, when adjacent portions of the site have differing concentrations of contaminants, and this can happen for a number of reasons, and Chris hit upon some of them in the first module. When you know or suspect this to be the case, ISM specifies reducing the size of the sampling unit or the decision unit to control this type of error. This would obviously result in more sampling units or decision units for a given size of site. The second type of temporal error is periodic heterogeneity fluctuation error, which is due to distributional heterogeneity over time. Examples of this and other cyclical changes over time are measuring nitrogen concentrations in agricultural fields over several growing seasons, or the changes that occur during industrial processing. ISM specifies spatial or temporal interval changes between samples to address this type of error. Now let's proceed back to discuss the sources of error that were identified by Guy that are addressed in detail in ISM-2. The first of these is fundamental sampling error. This is due to the very nature of the different particles comprising the material to be sampled. It's also known as compositional or microscale heterogeneity. Fundamental sampling error cannot be reduced to any degree by just mixing or blending, because this really does not alter the nature of the particles. Fundamental sampling error can also be a result of particle size in addition to particle composition, and it increases when the particle sizes get bigger or when you have a larger range of particle sizes. ISM reduces the compositional heterogeneity aspect of fundamental sampling error by increasing the sampling mass. And you can either do this by increasing more increments or by increasing the mass of each increment collected. ISM reduces the particle size aspect of fundamental sampling error either by sieving the samples to retain only a smaller particle size so that it's appropriate for the target receptor, or by milling and crushing all of the particles to a very fine powder prior to homogenizing and subsampling. It's important to note that fundamental sampling error can never be eliminated. It can just be managed. The next type of error is grouping and segregation error. This occurs if sampling procedures don't consider the contaminant heterogeneity exists at the site. In other words, if the sampling design assumes the contaminant is uniform throughout the specific area. As just one example, grouping error can occur in the field if collection staff gravitate to where soil is softer and it's easier to sample. What happens if these softer areas preferentially accumulate the contaminants of interest? The photo above shows the spilled white chemical that Michelle previously discussed. Contaminant heterogeneity is visually obvious at the time of the spill, as you can tell. However, this heterogeneous contaminant distribution will not normally be visually obvious when it comes time to sample. Take a look at the red dots and the yellow dots on the slide. The red dots are located at high concentration areas. The yellow dots are located at areas of low concentration or non-detect concentrations. Grouping error would occur at this site if you collected all of your samples at either all the red dots or all the yellow dots. And grouping error would be reduced if you sampled some of each, some of the red dots and some of the yellow dots. Please note that a discrete sample collected at any one of these locations would not have a concentration representative of the overall spill area. This is one of the main advantages of ISM. ISM field sampling procedures can reduce grouping and segregation error because they use a systematic random sampling approach and by increasing the number of increments collected. ISM recommends collecting at least 30 increments to reduce grouping and segregation errors, but please note some states and some regulatory programs require greater than 30 increments. It's important to note that the practitioner should consider whether collecting more increments is appropriate, especially when you have a high degree of heterogeneity or you for very large DUs. Moving on to our next source of error, which is the limitation error. This is caused by the size, shape, and orientation of the field sample collection tools. Various examples are shown in this illustration. Note the thickness of the decision unit shown and the blue particles that represent our theoretical contaminant. Pourer A, at the left of the illustration, has the appropriate shape, size, and orientation to pick up the correct ratio of blue particles. Pourer B, shown just to the right of pourer A, is too small to be able to pick up the blue particles, as it's advanced and simply pushes the blue particles aside. Samples collected with this corer would be non-detect or bias low for blue particles. Device C is the shovel shown at the top. It's the wrong shape and size. It simply could not be able to sample the full thickness of this decision unit using that shovel. Corer D, shown at the right edge of the illustration, is the correct size and shape. However, its orientation is all wrong. Pouring horizontally from the side of this pile would not collect a representative sample of the full decision unit thickness. This diagram shows how using a rounded scoop will cause the limitation error. The rounded scoop collects a sample that underrepresents the actual percentages of fine particles that have settled to the bottom of the pile, as you can see. A scoop with a rectangular shape, if it was used, would collect all of the particle sizes and the appropriate representative percentages. It's important for people to understand limitation error can occur both with field sampling equipment and laboratory sampling equipment. ISM reduces the limitation error by specifying the appropriate size, shape, and orientation of the sampling tools. Our fourth source of error is extraction error, which is caused by faulty sampling techniques that fail to extract the entire increment. Picture sampling a dry, sandy soil with an open bottom pourer that does not have a sample trap installed in it. As the corer is withdrawn from the ground, loose material in the bottom part of the sample can fall out. The collected increment would then overrepresent the upper portion of the sample because the lower portion has been lost. ISM helps to reduce this extraction error by specifying the appropriate sampling tools and techniques. Error source 5 is preparation error, which incorporates various errors that can occur during laboratory preparation of soil samples. Many of these preparation errors also have an equivalent field source of potential error. The photos above show various causes of preparation error. The photo on the left shows attempting to blend or stir a cohesive soil without breaking up the strongly aggregated clumps. The sample simply won't be able to be homogenized prior to subsampling. The center photo shows segregation of a non-cohesive field sample. This can occur simply during sample handling and shipping to the laboratory. You can see that smaller or denser particles work their way to the bottom, leaving larger particles on top. This ties to the photo on the right, which shows improper subsampling. It's a common laboratory practice to scoop the subsample off the top of the field sample as it's received. Many practitioners out there don't know that labs only collect a very small portion of the field sample to be analyzed. For example, only 1 gram of the sample will be collected for total metals analysis. Scooping just such a small portion off the top without homogenizing the sample is unlikely to result in a subsample that is representative of the entire sample. ISM reduces these preparation errors by having laboratory prepared subsamples using specified processes and special tools under controlled conditions to ensure that representative samples are analyzed and reproducible results are generated. More information on the laboratory procedures and tools for ISM is provided in Module 5 of this series. It's time for our next knowledge check. Nicole, could you pull up the question, please? Which of the two sampling errors identified by Gee can be reduced if you increase the number of increments of the ISM sample? Is it A, fundamental sampling error and grouping and segregation error? Is it B, fundamental sampling error and delimitation error? C, delimitation error and extraction error? Or D, extraction error and preparation error? Take a few seconds to select your answers. All right, it looks like just like Michelle's question, you all got it right. It's fundamental sampling error and grouping and segregation error can be reduced by increasing the number of increments in the ISM sample. It is not possible to reduce delimitation error, extraction error, or preparation error by increasing the number of increments in the sample. Now let's go back to Michelle to discuss the importance of properly developed sampling design.
Thanks, Tom. Frequently, there's a mismatch between the scale of observation and the scale of decision-making. What this means is that if we collect samples at a single point or several single points, we have data that is representative of just those points. We frequently make decisions about the entire site using this type of data, and the scale of observation does not match the scale of decision. Now, ISM increases the number of sample points and combines them into a single sample for analysis. Therefore, the data with the ISM sample is representative of a much larger area, much closer to the size of the area to which the decision is to be made. So how can we manage heterogeneity with sampling design? The first step is to identify the area or areas to be evaluated. The design should then select a method to collect representative data based on the soil characteristics and the likely mode of contaminant distribution. Now, these two items here are typically identified in the conceptual site model. The selected method should collect sufficient sample volume at a statistically defendable number of locations. These locations should be distributed without bias and using proper tools and procedures. The data should be confirmed that it is representative and reproducible by the collection and analysis of replicates. Now, if this process is followed, the data can be used with confidence that there is a reduced potential for decision error. Now, ISM includes these steps and therefore is a better method to manage heterogeneity by sample collection, processing, and confirmation. Now, the main elements to sampling design with ISM are decision units and sampling units. Now, both GUs and SUs are areas for which an average concentration is required, and they are areas to be represented by a single sample. Now, DUs are different from SUs in how the data will be used. By definition, a decision unit is a volume or mass of material about which a decision will be made. Specifically, it's the smallest volume of soil that will respond to ask about a question about risk or cleanup or attribution of chemical concentrations. Now, an exposure unit, or an EU, is the decision unit selected specifically for the evaluation of risk. Now, a sampling unit is similar in that it's an area and depth of soil to be represented by a sampling process. And basically, it can be applied to any defined volume of soil intended to be represented by a sample. Now, an SU doesn't necessarily need to be dependent on the intended purpose of the data. SUs can also support other types of sampling objectives, such as nature and extent, or collection of data in ways that don't neatly fit into the definition of a DU. It is up to the practitioner to decide what terminology to use to best communicate and define the different elements of their sampling design. Now, I'd like to provide you with an example of a sampling design where the objective is to assess the nature and extent of impacted soil resulting from the activities at a manufacturing facility and to assess if those pose a risk to human health and the environment. Now, in this particular case, the investigation was prompted by observations of stressed vegetation near the facility's wastewater outfall. The DU was selected to determine an average concentration of the area of stressed vegetation so we can compare that to regulatory soil screening standards. Now, one sampling design consists of a handful of discrete samples set on a grid spaced throughout the DU. One location targets the discharge point of the wastewater outfall, and then the other locations are distributed across the site in the area where the dead vegetation is observed. Now, in order to calculate an average concentration for this area, you're going to need at least 8 to 9 samples. From what we've learned about soil heterogeneity, these samples are likely to have very different concentrations, potentially orders of magnitude from each other. We also know from experience that laboratory results from the same soil sample are typically not reproducible. Now, while one sample at the discharge point of the outfall was strategically selected, the remaining locations, they don't really consider past surface topography, variations in soil types, moisture content, or the preferential contaminant distribution. It's unlikely that an accurate average concentration for this area will be calculated from the 9 discrete samples. Now, another sampling design that I have for you consists of an ISM sample made of 30 increments collected at systematically random locations throughout the DU. In this example, the ISM samples are collected in triplicate to confirm the reproducibility, and ultimately we have 3 ISM samples that would be submitted to the laboratory for analysis. The increased number of sample locations, the increased soil volume for each sample, and the sampling collection and processing techniques reduces the effects of heterogeneity. So here, if only the average concentration is required for this DU, the sampling design would provide a more technically defendable and representative data than data collected with the discrete samples. The disadvantage of this specific sampling design is that the resulting ISM sample would not tell us if there are areas within the DU that are more contaminated than others. It wouldn't tell us of the extent of contamination or if there's variations of concentrations within that DU. Now, in order to determine those variations in the contaminant concentrations that may occur in the DU, I went ahead and I divided up the DU into 5 separate SUs. I labeled them SUs because the data will be used to assess a portion of the larger DU. It's up to the professional putting together the sampling design to use whatever terminology that best communicates the overall objectives. An ISM sample is collected for each SU. One SU will assess if the wastewater outfall area contains higher concentrations, and then the other SUs will assess what direction from the outfall contamination may have migrated. This sampling design includes 5 additional ISM samples being submitted to the laboratory for analysis. And keep in mind, for this sampling design, I'm still collecting ISM samples in triplicate from the overall DU back on the last slide because I want to confirm sample reproducibility for the area for which a decision about further assessment will be made. Now, for this sampling design, there's a total of 8 ISM samples. This is one less than the discrete sampling design that I mentioned earlier. The representativeness and the resulting data for this design is well beyond that of the original discrete sample design, and it meets all of our sampling objectives. The resulting data takes into account the soil and contaminant heterogeneity, and it reduces sampling errors. Now, bear with me. I have one additional option for a sampling design at this site. This design is the most robust of the 4 examples. Here I changed up the terminology, calling the 5 sub-areas DUs instead of SUs. I relabeled the overall DU as an EU, or an exposure unit, to convey that the entire area is being evaluated for risk to human health and the environment. Now, in this example, all DUs will be collected in triplicate to demonstrate reproducibility in these smaller areas. The design here would allow me to make specific decisions regarding the volume of soil, which a remedial action would be necessary if some of those DUs contain higher concentrations than others. This sampling design does not propose samples representative of the entire EU. The average concentration of the EU can instead be calculated as a weighted average, as the sum of the average concentrations for each DU times the DU area divided over the sum of the area for all the DUs for which is basically the area of the EU. We can keep that all straight. This sampling design includes 15 ISM samples for laboratory analysis. Now, that's 7 more samples than the original 9 discrete sample locations. But the representativeness, reproducibility, and thus dependability of the resulting data is well beyond the data that would be provided from the other sampling designs. In this example, 7 additional samples provide defendable conclusions on how to manage the soil in a potentially more cost-effective manner. Because if you collect these samples, most likely you're going to get all your data in one mobilization. You're not going to have to come back and delineate further or step out. Now, if you're interested in reviewing, we have many more examples of sampling design, and they're provided in Section 3 of ISM 2. And then we also talk about the statistical methods for evaluating ISM results as part of Module 3, and Section 8 of ISM 2. And with that, Tom is going to wrap things up for us.
All right. Before we go, let's review the key takeaways you should understand from this discussion of heterogeneity. Soil is inherently heterogeneous on both small and large scales. Soil heterogeneity reduces sample representativeness and data reproducibility. This can lead to a range of decision errors, and incorrect decisions have the potential to impact project cost and project schedule, as well as have a negative impact on human health and the environment. Proper sampling design collects more representative samples and generates more reproducible data. It also reduces decision errors. Proper sampling techniques and equipment mitigate the impact of potential sampling errors and provide more representative samples and reproducible results. Key sampling theory identified 7 sources of sampling error, and 5 of these are addressed in detail in ISM2. ISM is a sample collection and preparation methodology. It's used to develop a sampling design to control and reduce sampling error. ISM is a way to generate soil data that is representative of the scale of the decision. Remember, discrete sampling generates data that is more representative of the scale of observation. Soil data collected by ISM helps us make more informed and more accurate decisions. And now we'll open
Thank
the
you,
floor
Tom.
To questions.
Yep, sorry. Thank you, Tom. And as always, we would like to hear back from you today, so please be sure to fill out the online feedback form that's linked at the bottom of this last slide. You can also access the feedback form by clicking the feedback and related links section, then clicking browse too. Filling out the feedback form and certifying that you participated will allow you to receive certificate of completion by email. At this time, we will open the questions and the question and answer portion of our training. At any time, you can type your question into the Q&A pod in the bottom of the right corner of your screen. We will try to get through as many of these questions as we can. The most popular question that we received during this module is, would you please explain how to determine the proper number of increments to collect within a DU? So, Tom, would you please provide a little more clarity on that?
Sure. It's a statistically based derivation. Gee's sampling theory includes the formula to calculate the proper number. 30 increments is generally suitable for most DUs to address the variability that you would encounter. We also had a question about why some larger DUs may require larger increments, and sometimes it just becomes a matter of believability. If your DU gets to be 100 acres or so, is somebody really going to believe that 30 increments collected over that DU truly represents a true mean concentration? So it's like I said, it's up to the practitioner when you get to those larger DUs to determine if you need more increments to have your results be believable and reproducible to all of the interested parties involved.
And Tom, I'd like to just add one more item. When you collect your replicate samples, those replicate sample results will confirm that you have the proper number of increments. If you find that your replicates are not within a certain range of reproducibility, then you may have to go back and collect additional increments. So that's the nice thing about ISM, is that you have that check to determine, okay, am I getting reproducible results? And if I'm not, then I got to go back and maybe increase the number of increments, because it's all really based on how heterogeneous the soil is at the site. So if it's pretty consistent, you can get by with less increments. But it's kind of a case-by-case basis. And again, 30 is a good basis to start from, and then you can go up from there.
Right. Based on the results of those replicates, you may also reduce the size of your DU because maybe you may have set up your DU incorrectly to begin with.
Correct.
I guess I'll just throw out there also that if you anticipate high heterogeneity, for example, PCBs, go ahead and start with more than 30. For example, EPA recommends starting with 75 when investigating PCBs.
Yeah, 30 is the bare minimum, but a practitioner has to take into effect the other conditions on the site.
Okay, great. Thank you so much to our trainers for that. Michelle, we do have one question for you. For the example about SUs and DUs, only one ISM sample was taken per SU. Why was only one ISM sample taken per SU?
In that particular example, because we weren't making a decision about risk or whether or not we're going to remediate that soil, it was just more of a for information, you know, like which direction away from the outfall are we looking at? So I didn't need the confirmed reproducibility on that particular sample or that specific SU. You kind of got to use, you know, what you need to use the data for. Again, when you're looking at making a significant decision, then you're going to want to do your replicates because you need that backup. Now, if you're just, you know, which direction might this be going in? And then you know, well, depend upon that data, we're going to have to come in and check another item or something, or, you know, maybe even remob. Then you can, then you don't have to do the replicates. And only one ISM sample would be needed for a specific DU or an SU. So I hope that answers that question. And keep in mind, the guidance document does have a lot more detail about that, about how many increments and what samples, what DUs or SUs that you might want to do replicates in and collect three or four or three samples. So that's in there. It's up to, you know, the professional that's putting together the sampling design.
Great. Thank you, Michelle. Unfortunately, that is all the time we have for questions and answers before we move into Module 3. If you need further clarification on the answers that were provided or would like to ask us more questions, please email us at training@itrcweb.org, and we will do our best to follow up with our trainers to get your questions answered. Special thanks to all of our participants today. Thank you to our expert trainers for being here today and for their contribution to this ITRC document.
This is Troy Keith again with the Tennessee Department of Environment and Conservation, and now we will begin Module 3, which will go over the main statistical concepts necessary to understand ISM design and is covered in more detail in Section 3.2 of the ISM 2 document. We will also discuss how to handle statistical analysis once the data are collected, which is the focus of Section 6 in ISM 2. This module will address statistical considerations in planning for data collection, covered in 3.3, of ISM 2, and specifically Module 3 will discuss the importance of statistical considerations in project planning phases, how upper confidence limits are developed with ISM data, how to use statistics in determining data quality, and using the appropriate statistical methods for data evaluation. I want to thank our expert trainer for Module 3, Haley Brudingham. In addition to training, Haley also contributed many hours to preparation of the ISM 2 update. And if you'd like to read more about her expertise, you can access the link at the bottom of the page for her bio. And now I will pass it off to Haley.
Thanks, Troy, and welcome everyone to the statistics module. So as Troy said, I'm going to be discussing the statistical concepts that are necessary to understand incremental sampling designs and the statistical considerations in the planning for data collection. And finally, I'm going to go over how to handle statistical analysis once the data are actually collected. So first off, why is statistics actually important? Statistics is used in order to facilitate defensible and transparent decisions and to make those decisions in an objective way. So we can use statistics to be cost effective, but at the same time, still be protective of human health and the environment. Today, I'm going to start by talking about data verification, validation, and usability. I'm going to talk about why ISM works from a statistical perspective. I'm going to go over various decision rules, including the comparison to action levels through the calculation of upper confidence limits, as well as background comparisons. And I'll show how statistics can be used to handle the problem of multiple sampling units within a decision unit. So keep in mind as we go through this module that it's really not meant to be a crash course in statistics. But I am going to go into detail on each of these topics so that you can actually be ready to perform defensible analysis for your project. So for some of you that might have some statistical background already, this module can serve as a review and an introduction to what's going to be a little bit different about ISM. For others, this module is designed more to serve as an introduction to what you might need a little bit more clarification on, either by reading the guidance document or by contacting a statistician. So first, data verification. Similar to other sampling techniques, data verification for incremental sampling designs involves making sure that the data are complete and that the sampling plan has been properly designed and carried out. So for ISM, this means ensuring that the correct number of increments were collected and the correct number of replicates were collected. This simple schematic shows an example where we have four decision units, and in this case, we want to collect each in triplicate. So data verification in this case means ensuring that we have three ISM samples, each from the four different decision units for a total of 12, and that the correct number of increments were collected from each. The next step in the process, data validation, is also similar to data validation for discrete data collection. So ensuring that the standard operating procedures were properly followed, for example, the laboratory SOPs, and confirming that the proper qualifiers were assigned, like correctly identifying non-detects. Note that because ISM designs typically have smaller sample sizes, you might have special considerations if you do have non-detects. So check out the document for more details on that. And then finally, the evaluation of performance criteria. So for example, were any data rejected due to not meeting the quality control criteria? And finally, data usability. Data usability is a retrospective look at the project objectives and the sampling design, and it's also similar to data usability for discrete data collection. So as a continuation of data verification and validation, the outputs from those steps should be reviewed to evaluate the conformance to performance criteria and the implications of unacceptable results. So for example, looking at whether the laboratory detection limits meet the sensitivity needs that were documented in the data quality objectives process. Data usability should be documented, and the conceptual site model might need to be updated. And then what new information was learned during sampling? So use that information to modify the study design or make final conclusions about the site. Let's talk about why ISM works from a statistical perspective. As many of you may have already experienced, discrete samples are sensitive to anomalies that might be present at the site. The image on the left shows the variation in concentrations we might expect if we collected discrete samples. But because ISM designs combine material from across the decision unit into a single sample, the sample result is going to be an estimate of the average concentration across the entire decision unit. So in this way, the sampling process actually does the averaging for us. The image on the right shows this physical averaging process that we have in ISM designs. So each of those three colors represent a single ISM sample. And in this example, we're taking three replicate ISM samples. Notice that for the ISM design, we have many more locations and information going into a single sample. And that's why a single ISM sample is going to be much more valuable than a single discrete sample, and possibly even more valuable than several discrete samples. Key advantages of ISM designs are the increased mass present for an individual sample, allowing for more information for characterization, and better spatial coverage across the decision unit. So these two advantages combined ultimately result in better precision compared with discrete sampling, because the design captures both those low concentrations and anomalies that might be present in a highly heterogeneous environment that's typical with soil sampling. And for more details on heterogeneity and sampling theory and the different types of errors, refer back to Module 2, Heterogeneity. For some projects, a single ISM result might meet your project objectives because of that increased precision we can achieve with ISM sampling. This single ISM result could be directly compared to an action level to make a decision about the site. But with a single ISM result, it's not going to be possible to determine the likelihood of exceeding an action level because there's no measure of precision or uncertainty. So if we need to quantify or evaluate precision, we're going to need to collect replicates. Also note that 95% confidence is a common requirement for environmental projects, and that can only be achieved by collecting three or more replicates. Collecting duplicates or triplicates from a decision unit and calculating performance metrics is a good way to evaluate whether the precision that's achieved actually meets the project objective. The coefficient of variation, or the CV, is the standard deviation of the replicates divided by the mean of the replicates. The relative standard deviation, or RSD, is that coefficient of variation just multiplied by 100 and expressed as a percentage. If the relative standard deviation, or the coefficient of variation, will be used to evaluate precision, then a goal for the parameter should really be specified during the project planning process. And typically, goals for the RSD are around 20% and 30%. And setting that goal does involve some level of professional judgment. Whatever metric that's used should be considered along with other site information to determine action at the site. Okay, now let's try our first knowledge check. So Nicole, if you could pull up that information. Which of the following factors allows incremental sampling to achieve better precision compared with discrete sampling? A, more locations within the DU are sampled. B, increased mass per sample and better spatial coverage. C, composite sampling always increases precision. Or D, none of the above, ISM does not achieve better precision. I'll give a few more seconds for people to select their answers. Okay. The correct answer is B, increased mass per sample and better spatial coverage. So this can be a bit of a tricky question, but if you answered A, it's important to note that the spatial coverage alone is not necessarily going to increase the precision of the results if the mass that you collect is similar to that of a discrete sample. So for ISM, we recommend collecting at least a kilogram of soil. So just try to imagine that volume of soil and think about how much more information we're going to have to get a really precise estimate. Another advantage of collecting replicates is that a confidence interval can be calculated with three or more ISM samples. The confidence interval quantifies the uncertainty around the estimate of the mean, and it's often going to be required in order to be protective of human health and the environment. A confidence interval specifies the probable range of the mean, usually with 90 or 95% confidence. With a 90% confidence interval, there's a 5% chance that the UCL, or that upper end of the interval, is actually less than the true mean, and a 5% chance that the LCL, or the lower end of the interval, is actually greater than the true mean. So in other words, there's a 10% chance that the true mean falls outside of the 90% confidence interval. The upper confidence limit of a 90% confidence interval actually corresponds to a 95% UCL, because there's that 5% chance that the true mean is above the 95 UCL. So typically, we're going to compare the UCL to an action level. If the UCL is less than the action level, then we're at least 95% confident that the true mean is less than the action level. Okay, so let's talk about how to choose a UCL. The most common upper confidence limits for ISM data are the Chebyshev UCL and the student's T-UCL. The T-UCL is the most reliable choice for normally distributed data. For approximately normal data, the Chebyshev UCL is biased high, meaning it's overly conservative. So in other words, the 95 Chebyshev UCL, is larger than it really needs to be to achieve the 95% confidence we need if the data are normal. But for non-normal data, the student's TUCL is biased low, meaning that desired 95% confidence is not achieved. The choice of the UCL should be made considering the nature of the data collected. The Chebyshev and the TUCLs are the only available choices for the very small sample sizes that are going to be most typical in ISM designs. But if you collected more than 7 replicates for a given decision unit, then you might have other options available to you. So check out the guidance document for more information on that. Due to the composite nature of ISM, the distribution of the sample results is going to appear more normal compared with the distribution of discrete samples. Here are 3 scenarios of different types of data. The pink curve in this figure is the distribution we'd expect if we analyze individual increments, and it's also the distribution we'd expect from discrete data collection. The blue curve is the distribution of ISM samples we'd expect if we collected 30 increments. Notice that the blue curve appears more normal, but it might still be skewed depending on the distribution of the increments. When the distribution of the increments is highly skewed, like in the far right figure, we may not be able to overcome this just by compositing. So in other words, we can't assume normality. Note that the CVs on the figure titles here describe the variation of the increments in pink, not the variation of the replicates, which is what we actually have data for. So because of that, and because of the fact that with only 3 samples, we're really not going to have this full picture of what the distribution actually looks like, then you're not actually going to be able to tell which of these scenarios you have. So to help you out with that, we've developed this rule of thumb for you. So we recommend using the TUCL when the CV of the increments is less than 1.5. And when the data are more skewed than that, then an alternative method like the Chebyshev UCL might need to be used. And I'll talk more about estimating the CV of the increments from the CV of the replicates on the next slide. If you're having trouble deciding which UCL is best, check out our ISM UCL calculator. The calculator is in the form of an Excel spreadsheet, which is pictured here, but the point is not to be able to read and understand each individual column that's shown. I just want to show you what the calculator actually looks like. The calculator uses the number of increments in each ISM sample, so remember to fill that in at the top of the sheet here. Then you can simply enter the sample results in these green cells for each of your decision units. So let's take a closer look at that field. For a given decision unit, fill in the area of the decision unit and the sample results for between 3 and 6 replicates. The calculator is designed to compute summary statistics for you, and it'll classify whether the CV is low, medium, or high. The calculator computes both the Chebyshev and the TUCL and gives a recommendation on which is going to be more appropriate based on our guidelines. The calculator uses the CV of the replicates calculated from the data and makes an adjustment to estimate the CV of the increments in order to recommend the appropriate UCL. And I've included the link to the calculator on the bottom of the slide. The calculator can be a useful tool, but it's important to also consider information you have available related to the site, like the CSM and the expected variation. The location of the UCL and the mean can help you determine alternative actions at your site. So, for example, if both the UCL and the mean are below or above the action level, like in scenarios 1 or 4 in this figure, then the existing data are sufficient to make a decision about the site because we're already confident that the mean really does fall below or above the action level. If the action level falls within the confidence interval, additional data might be needed to make a confident decision. So, for example, in the case of scenario 2, the mean is below the action level, but the UCL is above. So if our decision rule is comparing the UCL to the action level, we might conclude this site requires remediation. But it's possible to conclude the site is clean if we collect additional data such that the UCL drops below the action level. We could consider modifying the study design, like increasing the number of increments or increasing the number of replicates. So again, adaptation of the study design can narrow the confidence interval width. What's going to be most common is to increase the number of observations. For ISM, this means increasing the number of increments, or we could increase the number of replicates. Recall that one of the key advantages of ISM is the increased mass we have for a single sample. So if the number of increments are increased in order to improve the width of the confidence interval, then the mass of an ISM sample should also increase to maximize this benefit. Lower variability in the data also causes the width to be smaller, but we can't control this without modifying the study design. So in other words, we might have to increase the number of observations in order to compensate for data that are expected to be highly variable. Or we could try to redesign the placement of decision units in order to reduce that standard deviation. Another factor we might be able to control is the statistical confidence. For example, a 90% UCL is going to result in a narrower confidence interval compared with a 95 UCL. If we can be satisfied with only 90% confidence, then this adjustment could be a valid way to achieve a narrower confidence interval width in the case of scenario 2, like we saw on the previous slide. However, a 95% confidence interval is often a requirement for environmental projects. The last factor that affects the width of the confidence interval is the distribution of the data. The true shape of the distribution is not going to be known even after data collection because of the few samples that are typically taken for ISM design. Recall that the Chebyshev UCL is typically more conservative than the TUCL, meaning it gives a wider confidence interval width. That's because the Chebyshev UCL is a non-parametric approach, which does not require assuming a particular data distribution. With the TUCL, because we're assuming that the data are normally distributed, we apply that information to achieve a narrower and more precise confidence interval. However, again, this is not a factor that we're able to control. Similar to when we talked about variability, we might need to increase the number of observations to compensate for this in the study design. Now let's try our second knowledge check. When is it appropriate to use the student's TUCL over the Chebyshev? A, when the coefficient of variation of the replicates is less than 1.5, B, when the replicates are normally distributed, C, always use the Chebyshev UCL if the sample size is less than 7, or D, always use the TUCL if the sample size is less than 7. I'll just give a few more seconds. Okay, the correct answer is B, when the replicates are normally distributed. I saw that most of you were able to eliminate C and D, and that's great. Both the Chebyshev UCL and the TUCL can be used with small sample sizes. For A, this can be a bit of a tricky question again. Remember that this rule of thumb applies to the coefficient of variation of the increments, not the CV of the replicates. So if you're having trouble with that distinction, I recommend going back and looking at the example in the UCL calculator, and you can actually see the formulas that show the adjusted CV of the increments, which is used to recommend the appropriate UCL. Okay, so let's talk about multiple sampling units. For some study designs, you might have multiple sampling units within a decision unit. This is especially common with very large decision units. In this example, we've got an 80-acre field that's represented by a single decision unit. We could divide this into grids and take increments from each grid, just as we normally would if we had a smaller decision unit. But those increments are going to be pretty far apart. Recall that the spacing and the number of increments are what allows us to control precision. So in order to better account for heterogeneity, we could select a subset of these grids to use as sampling units and collect an entire ISM sample from within the grid. The increments would be closer together and more likely to achieve the desired precision. This technique should only be used if the concentration is not expected to vary spatially on a large scale across the DU. In other words, we expect each grid to have a similar concentration. Typically, this is going to be a case where the entire area is treated as an exposure unit. So check out the risk assessment section of the document or our upcoming risk assessment training module for more details on exposure units. We recommend selecting at least 10 of these sampling units. The 10 ISM samples can then be used to compute a UCL just as you would if you had 10 discrete samples. You might also find it useful to collect triplicates for one or more of the sampling units, depending on the requirements for your project and the information you already have about the level of heterogeneity. You can use one of the metrics we talked about, the CV or the RFD, to evaluate if the desired precision was achieved. Ideally, this should be done on the first SU before the other data are collected, because if the desired precision is not achieved, then the number of increments could be increased in order to compensate for that. A similar approach is when we have CSM equivalent decision units. So this is also going to be common for large areas where the concentration is not expected to vary much across the area. But in this case, the scale of the decision is going to be smaller. Instead of dividing a very large DU into several sampling units, we might divide the area into several DUs with the intention of making a decision on each individual unit. Those individual units are called CSM equivalent DUs. In this case, replicates are typically collected from only a subset of the DUs. The variances from the replicate DUs should be compared statistically. And if they're not significantly different, then you can use the pooled variance across DUs to compute your confidence interval. Depending on the project, it might be necessary to determine whether a proportion of the study area exceeds the threshold. This is called a not-to-exceed determination, and it's very different from concluding the mean of the area is below the threshold, but it might be of interest if the area exceeds the size that could potentially be of interest from a regulatory perspective. For example, we might be interested in whether the mean concentration across a 100-acre study area exceeds an action level, but we might also be interested in the proportion of that area that exceeds a larger threshold. This decision rule is going to be much more conservative, and many more samples are needed to support that objective. On the last couple of slides, we saw examples of a very large decision unit where the concentration was expected to be similar across the DU. But if there are differences in concentrations over space, then this should really be accounted for in the study design. So in this example, we have a residential lot as our DU, where we expect a high concentration in the front yard, a relatively lower concentration in the backyard, and an intermediate concentration in the side yard. The decision unit can be divided into sampling units according to those concentrations that we expect, which ensures each individual area is going to be adequately characterized during the sampling process. And refer back to Module 2 heterogeneity and also check out Section 3.1 of the document for more details on how you can properly divide a DU into sampling units for this purpose. With multiple ISM sample results for each sampling unit, a weighted average and UCL for the entire DU could be calculated. The UCL calculator I showed previously is also able to handle that particular calculation. Background comparisons are another objective that's going to be particularly common in risk assessment. The statistical methods for this type of comparison are going to be very different from comparisons to cleanup levels. And that's because cleanup levels are known constants, but background concentrations have variation. The true mean and maximum background concentrations are unknown, just like the true mean and maximum site concentrations are unknown. And the shape of each distribution is also going to be unknown. Most commonly, the project objective is going to be comparing the means of site and background concentrations. Appropriate statistical tests for that objective include the two-sample t-test, or a non-parametric alternative, depending on the shape of your distribution. ANOVA could also be used to compare more than two groups, for example, comparing two different decision units to one distribution of background concentrations. And less commonly, you might want to compare the upper quantiles of the distribution. So check out the document for more details on that. Whatever method that's used, we recommend comparing the site and background distributions through these valid statistical tests rather than relying on point estimate comparisons like background threshold values. Check out the ITRC's soil background guidance document for more details on this, and that's estimated to be released later this year. One of the most important considerations for background comparisons is the collection method of the background data set. Existing background data may be available for the site, but if those data are discrete, then they can't simply be compared with ISM site data. We recommend comparing ISM site data with background data that's also collected using ISM. If discrete background data are used, a statistician must be consulted for proper comparisons. Now, in addition to the sampling methodology, there are several other similarities that you might want to consider between site and background sampling designs. It's important that the volume of soil per increment and the number of increments per replicate are equivalent for both the site and background data sets. Both data sets should ideally have the same sampling unit size and volume and range of sample depth. Equal SU size and equal number of increments means you have equal density of increments. And remember that that controls heterogeneity and affects precision. But if it's not feasible to collect background data using the same SU size as the site data, then the expected scale of heterogeneity should just be evaluated with respect to that sampling unit size to make sure that the data will be comparable. And background comparisons work best when the sample sizes are equal. So the number of replicates for each DU should also be approximately equal. But if the sample sizes aren't equal, check with a statistician for guidance on how the comparison might be affected. And then finally, just like with discrete sampling for background comparisons, both data sets should be taken from the same soil type and the same field and analytical methods should be used. Whatever statistical method is used, the assumptions of the method should be checked or evaluated as part of the data quality assessment process. Assumptions will vary for different statistical methods. Randomness is a common assumption of nearly all statistical methods, and it should be a key element of your sampling design. There are different ways to incorporate randomness in ISM designs. Check out Section 3.1 and Section 4 of the document and the upcoming Module 4, Field Sampling, for more details on how you can incorporate randomness in your design. Other common assumptions, depending on the statistical method, are that the data are normally distributed and that they're independent. But note that depending on the sampling design, some of these assumptions may not be able to be checked. But you should just be aware of them and use information you have available to you to evaluate whether they're likely to be violated or not. This concludes the content of our statistics module. We discussed data verification, validation, and usability. We covered why ISM works due to the physical averaging process over many increments. We considered various decision rules, including the comparison of UCLs to action levels, and we reviewed how to handle designs with multiple sampling units. And finally, we discussed the statistical considerations of background comparisons. Thanks for listening, and I'm happy to take any questions with our remaining time.
Thank you, Haley. Again, as a reminder, we'd very much like to hear back from you today, so please be sure to fill out the feedback form and the link at the bottom of this slide, And doing that will also allow you to receive a certificate of completion by email. Also, as a reminder, this training course will be archived as well as many others, so please visit ClueIn, and if you want to revisit this training or see if there are other courses that interest you. And again, we will open this up to Q&A now. And one of the common themes seems to be, what is the statistical basis for determining the minimum number of increments? Again, we've mentioned previously that 30 is the bare minimum, but it also can greatly increase depending on the nature of heterogeneity within your medium. But Haley, if you wouldn't mind, touch on the statistical basis for the number of increments.
Yeah, that's a great question. And it was mainly derived during the simulation studies that we conducted. And those simulations are covered in more detail in Appendix B of the document. So if any of you are interested, I encourage you to look through that section. So, you know, as Troy said, that's kind of the bare minimum. So the simulation showed that on average, increasing the number of increments beyond that essentially results in diminishing returns. So you have kind of less bang for your buck in terms of the precision that's gained from collecting more increments. But again, that's not a hard and fast rule. So as Tom said earlier, if you have more heterogeneity, then, you know, you might still want to increase your number of increments. Or if your decision unit is much larger, then, you know, like I said, you want to have your increments kind of closer together to achieve that desired precision. So it really varies depending on the project. But if you're interested in the details of it, I encourage you to go back and look at the simulation.
Okay. Another, in one of the examples you gave, in the 80-acre decision unit example, how do you know the concentration of contaminants is not that variable among the different squares? In other words, you know, how do you assume heterogeneity is relatively consistent throughout the different squares? And the concern is that ISM may not be able to provide that information.
That's a good question. And if you are concerned about that, I would encourage collecting a larger proportion of the sampling units in order to really evaluate that particular approach. The approach that I discussed is really meant for if you are confident, whether based on the conceptual site model or the history of the site, that sort of thing, you are confident that there really is no spatial effect, that, you know, the concentration at one corner of the site is the same at another corner of the site. But again, it varies from project to project.
Yeah, and I would add that that's also where duplicates, replicates in general really come in. Had another question answered offline about the RSD target in this particular example. If it was an acute concentration, is a 20% RSD adequate? And collecting replicates allows you to determine your RSD, and with a good ISM, you really should be seeing about a 20% RSD or less. If you're seeing greater than, for example, if your RSD is 50%, that's an indication of a highly heterogeneous medium or a target analyte such as PCBs that is very, very susceptible to, you know, differential sorbing onto the particles. So increase the number of increments, and then again, collecting replicates will allow you to measure that precision and let you know if your ISM design is adequate, if your DU sizing is adequate, et cetera. Let's see, what else do we have? So if the mean is 5 times higher than the action level, do you still need to take a replicate?
Well, I think that depends on your project objectives and also the magnitude of concentrations that you're seeing. So, you know, if your project requires 95% confidence, then you would still need to collect replicates. You know, in some cases, you are comfortable with kind of uncertainty in the uncertainty that you're getting. So, you know, if that's the case, then you may be able to rely on a single ISM sample. But again, I think it just depends on the project and what your objectives are and what your values are.
Yeah, this is a kind of a common theme, whether or not replicates are needed. And as the document points out, so much of this is dependent on your data quality objectives. If you know at the end of the day the site is going to be covered by a parking lot, how much confidence do you really need in your mean concentration? You know the exposure pathway is going to be eliminated, so one ISM sample is probably adequate. If, on the other hand, it's a baseball diamond, and you know that people will be repeatedly coming in direct contact, you probably have a much higher, you know, requirement for a confidence level, and therefore replicates would come in very useful. Another question, is there a limit on how much data, i.e. increments, can be entered into the ISM calculator, and is there a way to directly import the data into the calculator for large data sets?
Well, just to be clear, you don't enter the value of the increments into the UCL calculator. It's only the value of the replicates that go into that. And the calculator is limited to 6 replicates or less. Beyond that, there are the formulas of the UCLs in the document in order to calculate those for yourself. Did that answer the question?
I believe so. I believe they did mean ISM, you know, concentration, not increments, but replicates.
Replicates.
So can you compare background composite results with ISM? And this may
I
be
think
a question.
That,
yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I think that depends on the number of increments that went into your background composites. In general, I would say no. Unless you have a very comparable number of increments. Really, ideally, your increments between the background and the site data should be equivalent. So there are adjustments that you can make statistically in order to compare discrete results or composite results with site ISM results, but those adjustments aren't exact, and really, I would encourage you to contact a statistician for more information on that.
Okay, thank you. We're already a little bit over. We've actually answered dozens of questions offline, but if in the event your question was not answered or you have additional questions or need for further clarification, please email us at training@itrcweb.org, and we will follow up with our trainers to get your questions answered. Thanks, everybody, for your participation today. Remember to fill out the feedback form. We very much want to hear back from you. And thanks to all of our trainers that participated today.